This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We start things off on the program today about food, about farms. What's the link between the two? Well, that's what our first guest in the program is going to be talking about. It's food columnist and author Phil Potempa, and he is celebrating the 15th anniversary with the Farm Cooking Show. And Phil's in the studio to talk about it. Phil, thanks for coming in and Regionally Speaking.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
First, tell us a little bit what I guess the idea behind the farm cooking column. I guess the columns are basically called From the Farm. How did the columns get started, and how did that end up becoming the Farm Cooking Show?
Okay, that's a great question, and it's an interesting timeline. In my newspaper career, one of the things that I started out as a news reporter, so I covered planning commissions and Board of Zoning Appeals, and eventually I thought to myself, instead of all these meetings and working all these nights, it would be great to move over to the features desk. And one of the things that they needed as a niche to be covered was food and cooking. Now, and sometimes folks will say, wow, you must be quite the gourmet chef. I always say, well, no, I'm more of a country cook raised on a farm, with my mom and dad and just sort of being around the kitchen know-how. But what they needed was somebody to write, again, for this weekly food section. And there was a feature that was called the Cook of the Week, which was supposed to be this idea of your everyday neighbor submitting a name of somebody that they knew was an extra neighbor or a church member that they see that would bring in a great potluck recipe. And they would submit it, and then it would be up to myself, the reporter, to find this person and then feature them and showcase them. Well, it was never very easy to get people to want to be featured in the newspaper. They were always a little bit shy about that. So eventually, we had a previous columnist that was a lady that wrote a column called Farm Fair. She was retiring, and I said, what if I take over that feature, and we'll just call it From the Farm? And that's how the idea was born, and that was back in 2002. So that's been, 15 years.
Wow.
Yes.
When you started the columns and you started featuring people out there in the rural settings cooking, what kinds of things, even say you had to kind of draw them out to get them involved to be in the column, what kinds of dishes, recipes did you have to get to be able to get them featured?
Well, I always say that this feature, it launched at the perfect time because it was May of 2002. It was just, within that stretch after what happened with September the 11th, and people, I think, were looking for something that was a folksy return to the type of visit you might visit over the fence with a neighbor and the type of recipes that are called heirloom recipes and everyday home cooking. And so a lot of the recipes that are anchoring this column each week, as it still appears now in the Post-Tribune on Sundays, are the type of recipe that, again, has been passed along from a family member. Again, that lady at church that always brings in her specialty for the church carry-in. So it's a matter of preserving those recipes. So my recipes come from readers, also from myself, from family members. And it's preserving those recipes in the column and then eventually also published in cookbooks, which will be shared on stage.
That's what I was going to ask you about. How did the cookbooks come about? Just the compilation of the recipes from the columns?
So true. And so many people will say, I have that kitchen drawer that's just stuffed with all these clipped out recipes that I'm always going to get to one day. So what a great idea to compile those recipes and columns, preserve them in a hardcover cookbook. And what do you know? Eventually now there's up to the third one that published in 2010 that preserves those recipes as well as the story that goes with them, because some folks will say, I don't cook, but I love that column or I love your cookbooks, because there's always a story that's associated with them that takes me back to a time where we think about when there were party lines or, before we had answer machines and cell phones, where things were just more of a relaxing, carefree time.
Now we have the columns and we have the cookbooks, and now we go to the Farm Cooking Show itself. And you're talking about the year 2010. That was the first year that's the last time, actually, that I understand that you've actually been performing on stage with this show. How did the stage presentations get started? And when you get them going again, which you're doing now, coming up here in April at the Center for the Performing Arts, what's going to be happening then?
Okay, well, what would happen is from time to time I would do these live presentations. It might be at the farmer's market in downtown Crown Point, or it could be at the garden show at the Porter County Expo Center or at the Lake County Fairgrounds. So I would once in a while bring this kind of the column come to life on the road with these cooking shows. And then in 2010 did a complete full-scale cooking show for the launch of this third cookbook, Further from the Farm. And I was at Star Plaza Theater, a two-hour whirlwind with seven recipes, a seven-course feast whipped up right before the audience's eyes, along with some favorite guests joining me on stage and lots of prizes and surprises. So that's what we decided was time to do once again for the 15th anniversary of this column feature. And that's April the 2nd, as you mentioned, at Theater at the Center at the Center Center for Visual and Performing Arts in Munster. So for $25, you sit back, relax, and just enjoy those aromas and hopefully go home with a lot of nice prizes as well.
Now, the first show, or the last time actually that you did the show, we should say, it was there at Star Plaza Theater. And with all the technology, even back then, as such, you could probably get lots of good close-up shots with the camera that people could see on the big screens and follow along and see what you're actually doing. How is the setup going to be over here at the Center for the Performing Arts?
That's so true. And, you know, the Star Plaza is a large space. That venue holds 3,700 people. The center, 400 seats. So it's much more intimate. And, the seats have moved fast. So there's still time to get those tickets. They're only, like I say, $25. But what I like is, as far as, the camera being right there in your face in the way isn't always ideal. So I like to go old school with one of those giant, large, tilted mirrors. I'm sure you've seen them. A lot of times the old home ec schoolroom classes would have those. So that mirror is always positioned just right. So folks in the audience are not going to miss any step of the recipe as they follow along in their cookbooks to see what's unfolding before their eyes.
Funny thing about it, too, that was also the way that we used to end up seeing the cooking shows on television. Even back in the black and white days and even early color days, the studio would have you set up with the kitchen set. And they'd have the big mirror there going across there, and then the camera would just basically zoom into the mirror to be able to watch what was being made at the time.
That's right. And, and PBS is certainly such a big part of what's, the cooking show history with Julia Child, who really kicked it all off. And I always include her in my columns and my cookbooks. I had the great fortune of interviewing her a number of times, and so there's always photos of her and I together. And some recipes we worked on together featured. So I always do a little salute to her during my cooking show, because she's the woman that really started it all.
Is there anything in particular, not giving away everything on the menu for this time around coming up in April, but anything in particular that those who come to the show will get to see you make?
Yes. One of the things I think people will find kind of interesting is a couple years ago, I was one of the finalists for Butterball Turkeys to be their male spokesperson. So they did a nationwide search, and I was one of the came down to the final three, and I was one of them. And I did not get selected, but as my parting gift, I received a Butterball deep fryer. So everybody's always so curious about these deep fried turkeys. So we're going to do one of those, ready in an hour on stage, so you're going to see exactly how that comes to be. So that's one of the recipes, along with a couple other favorite ones, all of them featured from this Red cookbook, which was the third cookbook published in 2010.
Now, once this one is taken care of in April, on actually April 2nd, starting at 2:30 in the afternoon there at the Center for the Performing Arts in Munster. You have any plans maybe to do another in the future?
Many people have talked about this, and it sounds like it's just a natural fit because, again, this one's been so popular and well-received that it lends itself to being a seasonal-type show. So if this one is the spring one, it just sounds like, wow, wouldn't it be great to have a fall one? And wouldn't it be wonderful to do one with the holiday theme? There's just not enough of this kind of, again, a relaxing afternoon out just to sit back and enjoy and share some memories and a few humorous moments because, that's what the kitchen is. And we are transforming that stage to a complete replica of our farm kitchen. So it's going to really look like something quite spectacular as it did in 2010 at the Star Plaza.
They had the recipes in hand. It was easy to do and probably not take very long to do the preparation for what you have to be able to pick up and get set up on the stage for the actual cooking. But how long has it taken to get things set up for this show coming up?
This show has been actually in the works for about the last 2 years. I've been talking with producer and general manager Richard Freeman at Theater of the Center. He's been wanting me to bring the show over to that space and venue, and we kept talking about it. And finally, finally it happened. And you're right, picking just the right recipes is a key component of it because they say, how are you going to do seven recipes in 2 hours? Well, again, there's some kitchen magic that happens. Mm-hmm. And like the columns, we always like to keep recipes to seven ingredients or less.
Well, you're not like the folks on the newest cooking shows here where they have a huge staff of assistants in the back getting things together, and so the presenters will have a chance to have things all set up and ready to go to put the ingredients together.
No kitchen elves in my kitchen.
No kitchen elves. Well, sorry about that, folks. You won't see any kitchen elves if you show up for the farm cooking show. Phil Potampa is going to be center stage at the Center for the Visual and Performing Arts in Munster on April 2nd. At 2:30 in the afternoon for this performance. Tickets still available. You can find out more by going to the center's website. And Phil, thank you very much for spending some time to tell us about, reminding us about the importance of food, in particular, food that we have grown up with, those comfort dishes and the like, and people on the farm here in Northwest Indiana, no doubt, have been making for families to make sure to pass on to their kids in the future. Thanks for talking about the cooking show, and we hope that everything goes well here on April 2nd.
Thank you, and I look forward to serving you and your listeners as my guest at that cooking show.
Green Cities Incorporated reports that East Chicago has the second highest number of asthma-related emergency room visits in the area, in fact, in the entire state. And so all the more the reason, they say, to be sure that in turn that some 4,100 students in the East Chicago School District can benefit from a new plan that in turn will use propane-fueled school buses. Lakeshore Public Radio Stephen Lattimore says that school officials are making the move because the technology can save money on fuel and can also cut the pollution output by some 80%.
This is the sound of a regular diesel school bus. And this is the sound of a new propane fuel school bus. It's like night and day. The pilot program at the East Chicago schools is made possible through a grant from BP in Whiting. They are buying six new propane-fueled school buses. Carl Lissick is executive director of South Shore Clean Cities Incorporated.
You know, on an average, we're seeing savings up to 60% total savings of a comparable diesel to a propane or auto gas, as it's called, technology. And again, with the number of gallons that our school buses actually use, to maintain the vehicles as getting our kids to and from school and after school activities, we're seeing, that's a huge savings. And, across the state, what we've seen is because of the mandates with education, we're seeing our schools hold on to our buses up to 12 years now. And so this just helps not only with saving money, but it also helps with keeping the cleaner technology on the road for the rest of Indiana.
For the schools, it means cleaner, newer buses that won't spew out toxic fumes that impact the children. Dr. Paige McNulty is the superintendent of schools in East Chicago.
So we have kids who line up at the on the sidewalk in the morning and after school, and they're breathing in. If we've got seven or eight buses lined up in a row, they're breathing in all the diesel that was being discharged from the buses, and obviously we know that that's not a good thing. So we're trying to do what's ecologically correct and make a difference in our kids' lives here.
It also means major savings in maintenance. Matt Lomas is with McAllister Transportation.
The after treatment that's involved on even a new diesel engine is a lot of maintenance, a lot of cost, a lot of upkeep for schools, and even so, you still have the emissions, you can smell it, the guys in the shop with the bus on, they can't have it on for more than a couple minutes without their eyes watering, kind of headaches starting. You have oxygen sensors on this engine like you do your car. That's it, that's your emissions package.
School officials say in the month that it's been up and running, the program has already become a success. They're now looking to buy more buses in the future. In East Chicago, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
The 2017 Kids Count Indiana Data Book, data that's been compiled from hundreds of national and statewide sources to be able to give us an idea of what it is like to be a child in the Hoosier State. And the latest figures show that Hoosier children are surviving, not thriving. In fact, that's the headline that's on the news release. It's out by the Indiana Youth Institute today. And with us to talk about it, we have the president and CEO of the IYI, Tammy Silverman, with us. Tammy, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
You bet. My pleasure.
Some good news and some bad news, and we even look at some of the figures as well for Lake and for Porter counties here. But taking a look first at the Hoosier State, give us an idea of how we see that, how successful things have been in programs that affect Hoosier children seem to be, I guess, this at least going from 2016 into this year.
Well, it's kind of a mixed bag, Chris. You know, just like you said, there are some areas where we are seeing some improvements, which is great. As far as cyberbullying, teen pregnancy, all of those numbers, the number of kids that are graduating from high school, all of those things have gone in the right direction, so that's positive. And at the same time, we have some real concerns that we need to pay attention to, particularly in areas such as child abuse and neglect, the number of kids that are living in poverty, teen suicide, and teen dating violence. Some of those areas, you know, our state isn't faring as well, and those are things that we can step up and take some action to help improve for our kids.
Let's take a moment first, take a look at the numbers that are out on child abuse and neglect, and tell us how the state ranked here, I guess, since going back as far back as 2011.
Well, we know that the number of calls that are coming in continues to increase. And so the state rates, actually, as far as our number of kids who have been abused or neglected, have risen steadily since 2011. And so you can take a look at that. Again, part of our data book is to look at it from the statewide perspective, but then you can also boil it down to your individual county. So that, for example, we know that in 2015, 17 out of every 1,000 Hoosier kids were abused or neglected. You know, when you look at Lake County, that number was a little bit lower. It was at 15 per 1,000, and Porter County was even lower than that. So both Lake and Porter County are faring better than the state as far as their number of kids who were abused or neglected. But overall, of course, we always want those numbers to be as low as possible because, again, we're talking about our kids who are in harm's way.
We're also looking, too, at figures showing how the Hoosier children deal with it's not, of course, not up to them. It's up to their parents, and their parents are having financial problems. It's not going to fare well for the youngsters. Tell us how the child poverty rates have turned out here based on the data.
Well, we know that overall for our state, unemployment is down, the median income is increasing for the state, and yet we know that one in five Hoosier kids still live in poverty. That's a little bit down but from the last year, from the prior year, but it's still slightly higher than the national average. And so if you look at that, about 20%, Lake County is actually 26%. So 26% of the kids in Lake County are living in poverty, and it's 14.8% for Porter County. So again, we want to take a look at what does that mean. Obviously, that means that more of those kids are likely to be homeless or to live in unsafe housing. They maybe not have enough food. There's not adequate child care. And all of those things compound into negative impacts for the kids themselves.
I understand, too, that at least from the statewide figures, that it turns out that it's families with only one parent that have the most problems these days.
Absolutely. And so, again, when you think about it, even breaking it down to economically, single mothers struggle the most. And so 50% of kids in single mother families live in poverty. And obviously, part of that has to do with if there's not parental leave or child care available, then that cuts down on their ability to earn a living that can help those kids as well. So, yes, most definitely we know that when it's a single parent and specifically when it's a single parent mother household, the economic challenges are real, both for that family and that child.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who's president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, taking a look at the data that's in the latest Kids Count data book for the state of Indiana and breaking some of those figures down for here in Lake and in Porter counties. I understand that a survey from high school students shows that many of them are apparently involved in some rather risky, potentially dangerous relationships. Tell us whether the teen dating violence fits into the picture in the data.
Well, teen dating violence, we know, unfortunately, both physical violence and sexual violence, again, Indiana ranks higher than the national average. So about 10% of Hoosier high schoolers who are dating report being physically hurt on purpose by a dating partner. Of those same kids that are dating, over 10% have been forced to have some sort of sexual activity that they did not consent to, which is 10% versus 6.7% nationally. So again, this is something where we need to step up as adults and help educate kids on what does a respectful, healthy dating relationship look like. You know, there's going to be some ups and downs with teen dating, but being awkward and having things not go how you want is very, very different than it being unsafe. And really those levels of abuse are something that we can all actively work to combat.
And sad to say, too, that Hoosier teens are still very prone to suicide, and there's some problems there. What Tammy did, the figures for the IYI show, at least from 2016.
Absolutely. What we know is that suicide is the second leading cause of death for 15 to 24-year-olds in Indiana, and that's been consistent for the past couple of years. And so, you know, they break that down into four different categories: the number of teens that have thought about suicide, those that have made a plan, those that have actually attempted, and those that have attempted and needed medical attention. And in all four of those categories, Indiana ranks higher than the national average. So this is something we need to pay close attention to because our kids are really struggling, particularly with depression. And there's a variety of factors that feed into that, but we're seeing the wake-up call in the number of kids who are thinking about or attempting suicide.
I understand there are a couple good points that have come out of the data. One of them involves the number of homeless students here in Indiana, as well as school bullying problems, because we still have that as a problem in our schools across Indiana. But I guess the figures show some improvement. Tell us about with those, please.
There is improvement in both of those numbers. Yeah. And so that's very, that's great news. The other one that I would say, besides, you're right, homelessness has also gone down for the first time in several years, actually. Bullying occurring at school has gone down. Cyberbullying, we see some improvement in that. We also know, and this is one of those key factors, that our teens are telling us that their parents are involved in their lives. So they tell us that if they were to attempt to skip school or if they were to use drugs or alcohol, their parents would find out and would take action. They also said that, you know, their parents are around and have clear rules. And we know those components are really safety factors, that kids that believe that their parents are involved, engaged, and that have clear rules really increases the well-being of those kids. So there is some good news.
And I understand, too, that as far as students who go on from high school to go into college, they work hard not only to keep up their grades and to be able to pay for the bills as well, too, help share the costs of going to college. And I guess we find now that there are more full-time college students that are finishing up on time, that they don't have to spend 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, rather, getting out of a four-year college.
Absolutely. A greater percentage of our kids are full-time college students or earning their degrees on time compared to previous years. And I know that's been something we've all talked about, you know, this six-year student. We're seeing more that are actually graduating in 4 years. We also know that, you know, as far as apprenticeships, Indiana has really been stepping up the number of apprenticeships that are out there and available so that kids, like you said, can succeed beyond high school. So we know that, you know, a greater number of our kids are engaging in the workforce and that we're providing those options for them to succeed.
Now, Tammy, who gets to take advantage of the data that is in the Kids Count book from the IYI? Does that information get shared with the state sources or with local sources as well to be able to help craft improvement to programs that need to be improved?
Well, you're absolutely right, Chris. We do provide that actively to those policymakers and those community leaders. But then in reality, it's available to anyone on our website, so anybody that's interested. So if you're an engaged, active parent or a grandparent or a concerned neighbor or a teacher or whatever that might be, you can go right on our website at IYI.org. You can look at the overall numbers for the state, and then you can also drill down and take a look at how your county compares to our state averages. Yes, we do use it for many conversations going forward on how to help kids, but it's accessible to everyone.
Information that's come out today about the data from the Kids Count book, but what other information comes out from the IYI here on a regular basis that people can use as well, not only from this data in the Kids Count book, but other data that comes out to help judge and make good decisions on programs?
Well, we pick up on a few of these issues and really go deep. Like we were talking about teen dating violence, we mm-hmm. have what we call an issue brief that's available that really goes into some of those root causes and talks about also not only what are the causes of that particular issue, but what you can do to help. And so there are a variety of those topics available that you can pull down more information. So we go a little deeper, as well as having some webinars and trainings and all of that. So again, it's not just isolated to data and numbers, but we go beyond that to say, what are the solutions that are available and how can we all step up and take action?
So it's probably a good idea to go online to IYI.org, take a look at what's there, bookmark the page so you can go and check back again, especially if you find out there might be some webinars or some other programs here in Northwest Indiana to check out that will be of benefit to you. Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Tammy, thank you for joining us to tell us the latest on the 2016, going into 2017, Kids Count book, the data book, and we hope to hear more back from you soon.
Thanks so much. A pleasure.
The Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana has chosen Purdue University Northwest as one of its latest monthly award recipients, and we have now a chance to find out why as we talk with Purdue University Northwest Chancellor Thomas Keehan. Chancellor Keehan, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, I understand that the award went out from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana because of what they are calling the merger, but of course we know that's unification. And tell us first off here about the fact that the unification has gone on now for over a year now and longer in its planning stages. I guess the Society of Innovators thought it was a very important part of the project of how Northwest Indiana grows. Tell us how you feel that the award is certainly well worth it.
Well, I think that there are a couple of component pieces that are important to the university and important to me as well. You know, one is that throughout the United States, we are just now starting to see some universities looking at unification or looking at merger as a way of ensuring that they can keep overhead costs lower in order to make university education affordable to many, many individuals. So I think that that in itself, the fact that there have not been a lot of mergers in the United States and the first in Indiana is significant to them and, of course, significant to us. I think the other important piece is that, you know, we've now been into the merger for a good period of time. But the years preceding the actual merger, we had a significant amount of work that took place in preparation to try to make this as seamless as possible. And I would say, you know, having now been into this, into our second full semester, that things have gone remarkably well. We, of course, have some small little hurdles to jump from time to time. But for the most part, particularly with our students, it has been a good situation for them and has allowed them to have opportunity to engage with both campuses, where in the past they only had one.
Do you think that the fact that you spent a proper amount of time, I mean, you being you and, of course, the faculty and staff at both the Purdue University campus in Hammond as well as the campus in Westville, spent a lot of time in the planning stages for the unification, that you've been able to go so long without having any of these little hiccups pop up?
Well, absolutely. I would say that, you know, the Higher Learning Commission, which is our accreditation group, actually required us to do a significant amount of planning. And although those people who I'm sure will be going through this in the future will look at that request and say, oh, this is going to be an amazing amount of work, it was an amazing amount of work. However, the work really helped prepare us for a number of aspects that we knew we were going to encounter. In addition to the preparation of the study for the Higher Learning Commission, we went through all of the operational portions of the university to make sure that we had systems in place to be able to integrate what we were doing as quickly and as carefully as possible. And quite frankly, there are still some of those that we're still integrating.
One of the upcoming mergers I know is going to be the campus of IU and Purdue in Fort Wayne, and they are probably looking very closely as how things went as far as the Hammond and the Westville campus unification went, and they have turned, I'm going to be told, I'm sure, the same things from the Higher Learning Commission to be able to make this merger that they will face over in Fort Wayne just the same, won't they?
I believe that that's true. I would say that, you know, one of the things that I hope for them will simplify their situation is that, number one, Purdue was the managing institution and will remain the managing institution. So there are a number of processes in place and financial stability issues that won't change at all, that they are completely in place. I think the other advantage that they may have is that the IU faculty and Purdue faculty that have been at IPFW have been working side by side for years. They had actually merged their faculty senate, and so the two groups, while having two different degrees and in some instances two different allegiances to Bloomington or West Lafayette, they do have fellow colleagues that work right down the hall and right on the same campus. And so my expectation is that, you know, some of behavioral concerns that you run into as you're consolidating to university will be lessened by the fact that they already have a culture that has been developed with them working side by side over the last number of years.
We're talking with Purdue University Northwest Chancellor Thomas Kean, the chancellor, and his colleagues and faculty and staff at both the Hammond and the Westville campuses are sharing another monthly innovations award from the Society of Innovators in Northwest Indiana for the unification of now the former Calumet and the former North Central campuses into the new Purdue University Northwest. Chancellor Kean, I understand that a lot of the issues that have come up and have been addressed here were taken care of because I guess there was an ombudsman that was established very early on in the unification process.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I had hoped, particularly in this first year of unification, is that we would be able to provide a mechanism to faculty and staff so that they would be able to go to a neutral party, share with that neutral party any concerns that they might have, and then that individual worked actually directly with me and would share with me those concerns or problems that were perceived by our faculty and staff. And then I could work with the appropriate units to try to reduce or resolve any of the problems we've had. It worked out, I think, extremely well. We used a consultant out of Chicago that spent one day a week on the Hammond campus, one day a week on the Westville campus. And that individual listened to a number of concerns, and I think many of them, 90% of them, were resolved to satisfaction. Probably the most important to me is that, as you might expect, at the beginning of the date of merger to Purdue Northwest, there were a number of people that took advantage of the ombudsman. And now that we're pretty far into the year, the load has lessened significantly. As a matter of fact, I had lunch with the ombudsman yesterday, and we were talking about some other kinds of things she might do for the remainder of her contracted year because of the lessening of people coming to her with concerns. Mm-hmm.
Now, since we're far enough along in the unification process, now into the first full academic year, do you find that there are still some things that you would like to accomplish with the unification to continue on? Or just pretty much things the way that they have happened and pretty much the way you're to your satisfaction?
Well, I think there are two pieces that I'd like to address with that. And mm-hmm. And one is that, you know, we still have some day-to-day issues that still need to be addressed, particularly with respect to processes associated with student data, student admissions, and student progress toward completion. But the other thing that has happened is that now that we are Purdue Northwest, people from the community are more conscious of who we are. They seem to be more excited about what we've done. And so we're having a lot more of the individuals in the community approaching us to have more engagement with the university. And it ranges from people who want interns, people who want support from faculty, to even people who are considering giving us some large gifts just because they're overwhelmed by the positive aspects of merging the two campuses.
That's probably something that maybe wasn't thought of about a year and a half or so ago when this whole unification process began, I would imagine, Chancellor.
Yeah, well, certainly at least hoped for, but not knowing that it would come to fruition as positively as it has.
We've been talking with Purdue University Northwest Chancellor Thomas Keehan. The Purdue University Northwest Unification Process is one of the monthly Innovators Award winners from the Society of Innovators for Northwest Indiana. And thank you very much, Chancellor, for talking about this. The best to everybody on both the campuses here in Northwest Indiana as the unification continues on as now we're Purdue University Northwest. Thanks for being with us to talk about this.
Well, thank you, Chris, and thank you on behalf of all of the faculty and staff and students of Purdue University Northwest.
Patrick Lipp is the Economic Development Director for the City of Valparaiso, and he and his staff have some big projects that are underway. And we'll talk at least about a couple of them here on Regionally Speaking today. A very exciting bike sharing program that the City of Valparaiso and Valparaiso University are getting involved in.
Yes, thank you. One of the focuses of our mayor has been on transportation of all various modes, and we have our bus service both locally as well as looking into Chicago, other modes of transportation. But the bike was something that we had spoken about previously, and one of the concerns of many communities is having to go out and actually buy the bikes, maintain the bikes, insure the bikes, and so that model would not fit for a community of our size. However, there's a company called Zaxter. And essentially, it's a turnkey operation where they provide the bikes, they maintain the bikes, they insure the bikes, and essentially provides the residents of your community an opportunity to engage in bike share in similar ways as I'm sure your listeners have been in Chicago or Washington, D.C. or larger cities where they have a more vibrant bike share program there. Essentially, Valpo will begin with 25 bikes throughout the city. There'll be about 6 to 7 bike rack locations strategically placed throughout the city. The starting date will be about April 15th of this year, so it's coming up pretty quickly. And you mentioned the partnership with VU. That's vital for the success of this program to have those students on campus utilize the bike. In my role as Economic Development Director, one of the holy grails I'm always after is to draw those students, those 4,400 students on campus to our downtown and to our retailers. And it's, if you drive through Valpo, you oftentimes will see the students going eastward towards your Chipotles and your Targets and your Best Buys and whatnot. But we want to have them come in our direction, although we have other modes of transportation to bring them downtown. We think the bike will be another alternative for those students there. We also see the possible uses for others in our community. We do have the V-Line, like I mentioned to you, about 11,000 riders per month ride on the V-Line. And so I suppose it's a nice sunny day as opposed to taking the bus. Possibly they may choose to take the a bike from point A to point B.
Now, there are a lot of opportunities that can be taken advantage of in the city if you just have the right transportation. And I can see why students at Valparaiso University, if they come in and maybe they have a car, maybe they don't. And if they do have a car, they don't want to have to spend too much on gasoline. And I can see why if there are things in downtown Valparaiso that students would be interested in, they ought to take advantage of those. And what better way to get them in there, and it's not that far of a trek, is to get them on a bicycle.
No, it's not. And actually, we refer to it as that last 4/10 of a mile. It's actually between our downtown and the western boundary of Valparaiso University, but 4/10 of a mile. And so it certainly is not insurmountable. And to your point there, trying to encourage the students as well as the faculty and anyone else that would happen to be on the VU campus to come down, as well as our residents. As you and I discussed previously, Valpo now has a valet parking service for the restaurants in the evenings to help alleviate some of the parking challenges we have downtown. And so for residents looking to come downtown and people to just park their bike on a rack and enjoy dinner or enjoy the downtown activities and then travel back home. Again, another opportunity to utilize a bike share as opposed to either their own bike or if they don't have a bike, not having to buy one.
I understand that this idea of a bike share program really originated with some studies that were done, in particular a group of Valparaiso High School students working with you and other people on this idea. Are they likely to be able to take advantage of such of a program as well, too, although it's primarily for Valparaiso University students?
Well, to answer your first question, you're correct in terms of the genesis of this. Every year, their pre-engineering class has a project that they participate in groups. And last year, the project focused on bike share, or on a countywide basis. And so, I and a couple other individuals were asked to come there and provide comments on the presentations, and that really got me and others thinking that, you know, just based upon the presentations and the data that these students have put together, that this project might work. In fact, when we reached out to Zaxters, they remembered a couple of students from Apple High School mm-hmm. that had called them to ask for information. And so certainly credits be given to the Apple High School teacher and their students for kind of planting that seed to move this project forward there. As to uses, in talking to Zaxters, they have about 150 communities throughout the United States that have their services there. The potential uses, the potential users are as diverse as you can imagine. In the university community, certainly the focus is more on the students. But there's, I presume that there will be a year from now when we do our analysis to see if it's worthwhile to move to a second and beyond that, second year and beyond, that we will review the data and we will find a user group or user areas that possibly we didn't even initially anticipate. And so we're excited to see how well the community adopts and utilizes this this bike share program.
We're talking with Patrick Lipp, who's the Economic Development Director for the City of Valparaiso, about the new bike sharing program that is going to be getting underway very soon. It's a cooperative venture between the city and Valparaiso University so that VU students will have a great opportunity to take advantage of bicycles to get from the edge of campus into downtown Valparaiso to enjoy the amenities that are there that maybe they aren't able to take care of because of the fact that they'd have to drive, and of course then you're dealing with parking and the like. This is one way to avoid the parking problem. Is this program going to be a year-round affair when it gets started here, other than just the annual reviews?
Yes. In fact, in working with the Zaxter folks, as mentioned earlier, this is a turnkey operation that they take care of the maintenance. And so that question came up. Certainly, if you're in a community further south where the temperatures don't get as crazy as they do in our neck of the woods, it's a lot easier to go year-round. But they encouraged it to be year-round for a couple reasons. One is that so that the potential user knows, regardless of the day, the time, or the hour, a bike will be there. And then secondly, as you and I are well aware, our temperatures in our area can fluctuate, and you can have a very, very nice January or February day where the bike use would be appropriate for that particular time. And so it will be the bikes will be available year round to the students as well as to the residents of the community. And again, hopefully we'll have a nice winter next year as we are having this year.
And we can only hope. I know one of the other projects I know that you and your staff there at the City of Valparaiso are working on is one that's come out in discussion just recently. It's taking advantage of a closed up factory building that used to be a very active place in Valparaiso and giving it a new purpose and a new home. Tell us about how you'd like to see the Chicago Dash project get involved with the ANCO building.
Correct. The Dash has been of the many successes that we've experienced in Valparaiso. The Dash certainly ranks towards the tops of that. And you have to rewind back to 2007 and 2008. And again, with the leadership of our mayor, the focus and the vision was to bridge and have that connectivity with Chicago. There's no sense building a wall and not embracing the fact that we are within an hour's drive, if you will, of one of the largest economies, not only in the nation, but in the world. And so in 2007, we began the Dash commuter bus service to Chicago. At that point, it was two buses. We're now up to four buses. About 135 people per day take that bus and commute and work in downtown Chicago. To a certain degree, our success has created new challenges in that now the parking lot that was identified near the corner of Campbell and Lincoln Way is full. Anyone driving by past 6:30 on any morning, weekday morning, will not only see that parking lot full, but will also see parking spots along Lincoln Way also full with people utilizing the commuter bus there. And so we knew that we needed to identify a new, larger location, both for our current users, but moreover, as we add additional buses. There'll be a fifth bus added in 2018 and a sixth bus added in 2020. And so there are various proposals and various areas that we looked at. One of the goals was to have this connected to our downtown to have more potential users for the amenities you mentioned earlier in our downtown area. And so one area that's been a challenge for literally decades has been, as you referenced, the old Anco Wiper Blade building. It's a beautiful building from the outside and structurally quite sound. In fact, there's multiple buildings there. Some of your listeners may visit Homenclature, which is a business in one part of the building in that area there. But it has lacked some sort of a unifying theme or unifying use, if you will. There are various environmental challenges on the property as well, which I think has also contributed to the lack of any development or use beyond warehousing and things of that nature. And so working with our redevelopment commission, we identified that location as to where we will move the Dash parking as well as the as a bus depot from its current location on Campbell and Lincoln Way, south of the railroad tracks, if you will, to the ANCO building there. We're working with the owner and their attorneys to finalize that, but at the redevelopment commission's February meeting, they announced the intent to acquire that property and move forward.
I get the impression that even though that the ANCO building, the main part of the building is vacant, of course, and it may not be suitable for some uses, I guess there might be some use to portions of the building so that you wouldn't have to take the entire building down to create the parking spaces that you need.
Oh, correct. Yeah, right now, in terms of the available space, I believe we can put in excess of 300 spots, which more than doubles our current capacity, which is sufficient for current operations there. The current plan is to maintain as much, or retain, I should say, as much of the current buildings on the property as possible. You know, simply raising everything down is not the intent. I mean, just the architecture, the optics, there are some that have complained about the water tower, and you drive by, it's an old, rusty water tower, but it's structurally sound, and that might add to a nice feature or an amenity, optic amenity, if you will, in the eyes of the right developer on that. And so the current plan is for the Redevelopment Commission, working with the city, to put a parking lot in that particular area there, to have the bus depot and operations move down there. And then most likely we will, the excess property, put out for an RFP to get the best ideas as to how the rest of that property could be developed in the appropriate way. The benefit will be is right now there are environmental challenges and concerns. At the point when we're done with the property, we will have addressed those. And so I think once with that sort of black mark or black cloud taken off, if you will, I think you'll see more developers interested in providing their best ideas and acquiring the property.
And what kind of timetable would you like to be able to put into place here to have things moving along here if things work well and you've gotten the support for the purchase of the ANCO building to be able to do what you want to do?
Sure. It's pretty aggressive in terms of timing, and I don't want to speak too or assume too many facts, but essentially we hope to close on the property in the latter part of this spring. And the goal is to move the parking down from the Campbell Lincoln Way area, if you will, down to ANCO this year. There is some additional utility work that needs to get done in the current parking lot, and so the timing couldn't be better. And so if all things work out well, the parking will move down at some point this summer or early fall. And then probably sometime in 2018, depending upon what IDEM and other agencies require us to do in the property to put it into condition where it could be then deemed clean for commercial use. Probably sometime in 2018, you could probably anticipate seeing our requests for proposals or requests for ideas to the public sector as to how the property would be developed. As things stand right now, it is very, very unlikely you would see residential development on that property, given the challenges there, but certainly a commercial use, a maker space, a co-working space, classrooms, things of that type of use might be consistent with the building.
I suppose too. That's because that's primarily because it was a factory. Of course, there too, the zoning probably is still pretty much industrial or commercial, to be sure.
That's correct. And currently, the zoning is industrial. Obviously, when the proposed uses are accepted, we may need to tweak the zoning to accommodate that. Mm-hmm. But I'll also say that another goal has been for the city is to encourage downtown living. We've seen a couple projects completed in the last year of apartments and condos in our downtown area. Those buildings that do have living quarters or units on second floor are predominantly full. And so one of the goals of this project is that at some point there may be residential development, not on the AMCO property, but in spots nearby that would supplement and complement the DASH service. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with out in the western suburbs of Chicago, your Naperville's, your Lyle's, your Aurora's, places where you have Metro train stations, not mm-hmm. unusual to see old converted warehouses or buildings being converted into living units. And, those commuters hop on the Metro, go down to Chicago, work, come back, and literally walk to their front door. And our hope would be is that with the DASH service and its ease of use, that we may see some of that development circling around, if you will, the Anko property. But that's a couple years out.
Well, it's something to look forward to, something to look forward to maybe the possibility for some loft apartments or something in some of these building areas around the Chicago DASH area, in particular when Chicago DASH is able to move the parking lot, as you say, to a property there at the old Anko plant sometime maybe yet this year. Patrick Lipp is the Economic Development Director for the City of Valparaiso, bringing us up to date on some major projects on not only what they want to do to be able to put in better and more expansive parking for Chicago DASH users as they commute to Chicago to work and home, as well as finding out the latest on the bike sharing program. It's getting underway. It's a project between the City of Valparaiso and Valparaiso University. Patrick, thank you for the updates, and we look forward to hearing more from you here in the near future.
Thanks, Chris, for your time.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us.